Right, ladies and gentlemen, I know you all came to hear the pretend farmer, the biggest celebrity in the county, but his follow-up act takes no introduction. Chairman of Natural England, Tony, it's brilliant to have the sort of, poacher in with the gamekeepers. Is that, I suspect you've probably been introduced that way before, but it's great to know that we're represented well in at the senior level in advising government. I know a lot of the audience itching to hear your perspectives of why Elms is designed this way, what you're aiming to achieve, but also how that private finance piece comes in, which ultimately is why really we're here today. So over to you. Thank you, Tony.
Well, thank you very much for having me today, and thank you for organising this fantastic meeting, which I think really is a kind of sign of the times, really, listening to questions today, just realising how quickly things have changed, even compared with a few years ago. It's been my honour to be involved with different elements of the conservation and environmental and sustainability story for getting on for 40 years. And it's just in the last few years that we've seen this really quite dramatic shift in the level of the conversation, whereas it was once quite a marginal discussion going on amongst environmentalists. Today it's become very mainstream, including in how government is now trying to shift agricultural policy. And, you know, you don't need to pay attention to realise that there's some really big issues that are now on the table, which have crystallised in the policy world and in the public mind and in the political world in the form of this climate change and nature emergencies, these two twin challenges that are closely related to one another, which have now broken through to the point where it just seems like there's now unstoppable momentum to do something about these huge big subjects. And as I say, it's not so long ago where this stuff was still quite contested and even, you know, denied in terms of the reality of the challenge that we face. But we are now into a period of rapid global warming and a mass extinction of animals and plants and the decline of ecosystems. And we're at the last moment when we've got a good chance of being able to avoid the worst of this. And so the policy shift couldn't be more timely, nor more important. And of course, if you look at those huge, big challenges we face in terms of changes in the basic chemistry of the atmosphere and the unravelling of the web of life, sitting in between the two of these things, both in terms of what's driving a lot of it, but most importantly in terms of the solution, is agriculture. We have to feed the population. And there's multiple layers to all of this, and, you know, some of it's to do with chemistry and the rise of pesticides, some of it's to do with nutrient pollution of the environment, some of it's to do with the expulsion of carbon out of the soils and into the atmosphere, and some of it is to do with the underpinnings of how pollination and soil biology work, and all of these different things, not only being environmental issues, but also agricultural issues. And so finding ways in which we can line up low carbon emissions and indeed negative carbon emissions with the recovery of biodiversity at the same time as producing a large quantity of food, at the same time as diminishing pollution, that's the job that we have to master. And actually, it's not only about different elements of science and how we can change this particular practice or this particular chemical, it's actually about a way of thinking, I think. And it's something I sometimes called horizontal thinking, because if you think about how government often works and how the world often works, it's often divided into silos, and those silos are things like energy policy, what we're going to do about water, food policy, and forestry. And, you know, very often it's quite hard to see the connections across them, so the horizontal connections between different elements of what we need to do to achieve good outcomes for society. And so that idea of horizontal thinking, whereby food, energy, climate, nature, forestry, and water, actually become part of the same kind of thinking rather than in separate silos is the step that we need to make. And I spend quite a lot of my time engaging with DEFRA policymakers and ministers about the need for more integrated approaches. That's what it comes down to, more integrated thinking, so that we can stop thinking about one thing at a time and disastrously thinking about these things as choices. Is it food or is it nature? Actually, of course, it has to be both for either to be able to work into the future. And so getting into that mindset of integrated thinking is really quite a critical piece of what we now have to do. And it needs to be done at scale as well. And so, you know, integrated thinking in one farm, fantastic, but integrated thinking across 50 farms in the same catchment, it's a whole other level of impact that can come from that. And so this is now why the new policy is really quite exciting, because we have moved into a space where these kinds of ideas are beginning to be thought about. And listening to the conversation today, as we went around thinking about carbon, biodiversity, water, some fantastic insights I got, including the water that's falling on the hills up here. In 2 days, it's in the even load. In 4 days, it's down at the confluence of the Thames. And then in 10 days, it's down in central London. And so the connections across the landscape, they're very real once you start to think about it. And so if we are going to be able to reverse these awful ecological problems that we've got to adopt integrated thinking. And it needs to be done at that landscape scale, which is now part of the policy through these landscape recovery pilots. And I'm hoping that what we will see as we go forward is that we can achieve integration at three different levels using these kinds of new policies. And so level number one that we need to find integration in is about the outcomes. So what we want is a clean river. We want more carbon in the land. We want less soil erosion. We want more wildlife, and we want good food. And if we can integrate those outcomes across farms in the landscape, then we're going to make a big step forward rather than seeing them as alternatives. Is it food or is it nature? We've got to get beyond that. The second level of integration we need is in the policies. And so we've got environmental land management. That's great. But we need to integrate that now with local nature recovery strategies and also the new tool of biodiversity net gain plus the net zero policy. Can we do that? Yes, of course we can, if we're thinking about these connections across the silos. And then the third level of integration that we need is the different actors working in the landscape. The farm owners and land managers, the water company, the official agencies like Natural England, the local nature partnership, the forestry commission, all of these different bodies working on a similar plan and finding ways in which we can actually start to build bridges between those different organizations and interests so that we can unleash their expertise, their energy, and to start to be able to use their different budgets and their different capacities together rather than in parallel or in the worst situations in conflict. So those integration levels of outcomes, of the policies and tools and the actors, very visible here today, I thought, as I was listening to the conversations that were going on, really quite a big step that's being made in this landscape through the kinds of things that are being done. And of course, the policy in the end will only take us so far. You know, the unleashing of the private finance now into the system has to be the next step that we go towards. And there are, you know, several markets beginning to appear already. Some of them actually have got some policy drivers behind them. Biodiversity net gain is going to be one tool which is coming into effect later this year. That will help in generating a need for biodiversity credits to be supplied from the landscape in order to enable house building. The carbon market is beginning to emerge. More work needs to be done on that. There's a new market emerging on nutrients, which we're very active in Natural England, which is seeing the use of protections for key sites being used to drive mitigation for nutrient pollution, which is leading to credits being generated through wetland creation, for example, which is enabling then new houses to be built. And of course, the health and well-being dimension of all of this, another layer that hopefully we'll see natural capital values being invested in as we go into the future. And actually, Tim, who took us around this morning, gave me a fantastic insight about the amount of financial capital now in the world. There's a lot of it. And of course, all of that financial capital was ultimately derived from natural capital. if we want to keep our economic system going, and indeed our very civilization functioning, we've got to start ploughing that financial capital back into rebuilding the natural capital that enabled it to be generated in the first place. And so what are the mechanisms to be able to do that? And so we've got people here today who are in that world of green finance, trying to find ways in which we can start to gear the investments back into how we maximize natural capital. Government's looking at this. I spend a lot of time speaking with policymakers about it. My basic message to them is about the need now to get some clear standards so that everyone can know what good looks like, to start helping to de-risk investments so that we all know what kind of goals we're trying to achieve, and also to find some way of accrediting good investments so that people know that they're actually meeting the right standard, and everyone can see that, and everyone can avoid the challenge of greenwash that may come in some cases. So the steps are being made now at multiple levels, and actually there's an intangible piece which I just have to finish with, which is the policy, you can write it down and you can see it. The integration, you can describe it and you can kind of map it. The thing that really is going to unleash this and make everything now possible is a very intangible thing, and it's called leadership. And the fact of you all being here today and working together, I think, is a fantastic example of that. And so what we have to keep doing is working together, put differences and competition to one side as we face in to this existential emergency of extinction and global heating, and see how much we can get done and how quickly we can do it. We're pretty much out of time now, and so what we do every day really counts. Thank you so much.
Tony. Thank you, that was brilliant. I did ask Tony if he had 5 minutes of questions, let's hear if there are any, particularly any farmers in the room. Oh, Matt, come on then.
Interested about the horizontal integration you talked about, and what hopes you have for any land use framework that might come out of government, and crucially, how that might be delivered locally.
Can you just say who you are?
I'm Matt Whitney from the Local Nature Partnership.
Thank you, Matt. So the question is about land use framework. So government has set a lot of targets recently, including on subjects we're talking about today, biodiversity, water quality. There's a whole architecture on net zero. And there's also targets for house building, of course. And although not official targets yet, quite a big expectation that we'll be producing a lot of our own food into the future. Of course, in terms of the carbon capture, the biodiversity, the house building and the food production, it's all taking place in the same landscape. And so we're going to have to find ways of optimizing how we do all of these things, plus energy generation, plus, you know, industry and public recreation, all on the same amount of land. And so this has led to really quite an important step, which is the development of a land use framework, which is being taken forward now by DEFRA ministers. And they told me recently that in the wake of the new environmental improvement plan, which has got the new official targets, the next job is to get into the land use framework. So this is potentially an exciting step. Natural England will be helping them as much as we can. Probably one thing that is important to bear in mind is the extent to which a DEFRA land use framework is not going to be sufficient on its own. It's going to have the business department, the transport department, and the housing department, amongst others, involved as well, if we're going to be able to reconcile all of these demands. So hopefully that will be a next step down the track. The other thing which is important to note is the Levelling Up and Regeneration Bill going through Parliament just at the moment, and the extent to which we are hopeful that there will be an amendment to that legislation which will include a read across between development planning and local nature recovery strategies. Because we've got two parallel tracks at the moment, one which is working out where the housing and infrastructure will go, and another one which is working out where the nature recovery will go. And if these things don't talk to each other, we're just going to recreate the problem we've had for the last 70 years, whereby these things keep bumping into each other. So again, another example of how we have to do integration, and hopefully an opportunity to actually do it. And I'm not allowed to advocate policy, but I just did.
Hi, I'm Caleb. I'm from Finance Earth. I think we've got like a really good range of people in the room today. And I'm just wondering, Tony, if you had kind of one dream for us all to work together on, what should we focus on? What one thing should we do?
Thank you. Well, I mean, the energy and the participation here today reveals that this landscape recovery pilot has got an enormous amount of momentum behind it. And I think if there's one thing that you can do is to make this work, make it really work, get the private finance in on the back of the initial kind of policy stimulation, find ways in getting everyone to be on the same page, make the most of the local nature recovery strategies, and to really make it famous as a success. I think, you know, having been involved in all of these different subjects for quite a few years, I look back on it and we've made progress, and the breakthroughs always come when abstract ideas turn into practical examples. That's when you get the breakthrough, because then it becomes impossible to say, oh, that won't work. And so if you can make this work, then any sense of doubt, join up food, carbon, water, nature, livelihoods and everything else, it disappears because it's been proved that it can be done.
Thank you. Really encouraging. Come on, more questions.
It's a question for the farmers in the room, really, to ask you. Should we be at all worried about the Elms budget, given the pressures on public finances? Oh, from Farmers Weekly.
It's too late now. I've said far too much already. The commitment to maintain the level of funding that we had for the Common Agricultural Policy, that commitment expires at the end of this Parliament. So whenever there is a general election, and whoever wins the general election, there will need to be a decision about the extent to which the country continues to invest in agriculture. I think I would say that given the scale of the environmental challenges that we face and how much we need to do, that probably we need to see a considerable increase in the farm budget on the far side of an election because of what society now needs from the land in terms of nature recovery, the purity of our rivers, the carbon capture, plus also secure and sustainable and healthy food. It's not something that we can take for granted as a package, all of those things. And so I would suggest that considering how the agriculture budget is the biggest part of our environmental delivery, that we need to look at that in terms of delivering quite a lot more than we are at the moment, because the trends that we have in terms of agricultural landscape, wildlife and the carbon challenge, they're very steep challenges.
Just following on for that, yeah, what am I, strategic member of the Agroecology Board. Fantastic. Following on from that, do you think that the Treasury have that understanding, and how do we make sure that they do if they don't? Because that's going to be key.
So obviously Treasury are competing with Treasury is trying to deal with multiple competing demands: health, education, defence, and environment. And, you know, the case will need to be made that this is a sound investment in the future. I think, you know, part of what will make a convincing case to any government is the extent to which we're going to get big returns by investing in nature recovery and the sustaining of the natural environment. Because very often it's been seen as a cost that we can't afford, when in fact the public health and well-being benefit, the food security, the carbon benefit, tourism benefit, you start adding it all up, and actually it's a very big contribution you get to overall economic well-being by making that investment. If you don't make the investment, you get a degraded environment, and the costs that come with that are astronomical.
Who's your ambassador?
Pardon me? Who's your ambassador? Who is our ambassador to make that case?
Yes.
Well, all of you, for a start. People get together in associations, don't they? This farm cluster is an association. Other people are organised in the RSPB or the National Trust or different ways. And I think the more voices that articulate that understanding about the join-up between economy, society and the health of the natural environment, the better. I mean, part of the challenge is that we compartmentalize these things. I've never ever seen a successful attempt to get one voice out of nearly anything. So I think we have to live with that.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Annie Jenkin from the Windrush Catchment Partnership. The world's been here a long time. There is only one world, and we're very finite, each of us, in the time that we're here. It's a fantastic talk. Thank you very much. But how do we achieve what we all very much want to achieve, given a sort of government elected on a five-year basis, the same with the local councils, etc.? Interested to hear.
Keeping warm at least. So I guess the question is about how do we kind of keep sight of the long term and keep focused on the long goals, because these things are huge and they're never going to be solved in one year or one parliament. So one of the things that I used to be the director at Friends of the Earth, and one of the things we did there was to run a campaign that turned into the Climate Change Act of 2008. And the reason we ran that campaign was exactly the reason you describe. Because back then in the early 2000s, we could see growing political interest in the climate change challenge, but always the fear that the next minister or prime minister may not have that interest. Therefore, if we had a good policy now, how do we know it's going to be there for the long term? And so we said we need an act of parliament that will carry the baton between successive governments out to 2050 at least. And so that's what we campaigned for, and we got that. And it's been hugely successful. And based on that architecture of having a long-term target and five-year interim targets, plus a delivery body to be able to keep sight of what's progress is being made, a successful attempt now has been made to turn a similar architecture around on nature. So looking like the climate change policy, but on nature. And so we now have these environmental improvement plans, which are linked to the 25-year environment plan, and with a body in the form of the Office for Environmental Protection to monitor progress against that, with us helping with delivery alongside the Environment Agency and Forestry Commission and others. So hopefully what we now have is something that does carry the story between governments, no matter what flavour they are. And, you know, the legislation could always be changed by subsequent parliaments, but I can't imagine any circumstances now where the Climate Change Act would be repealed or the new Environment Act would be repealed. We're on a journey which has got real momentum now, I think. But having that orderly transition so that we can keep our eyes on the targets, this is critical, because we don't have time now to slip, because we've left it rather late.
Thank you. I'm very conscious that we're between you and a tour of Farm Ed, which I'm sure you are very keen to look at. So I think unless there's any more burning questions, particularly looking at cluster members here. Poor representation, goodness me. Thank you so much, Tony. It was an absolute delight to have you up here. Thank you. We'll get you back up in 2 years' time when we've got the blueprints.
When the river's beautiful. Thank you very much.
Right, we're going to move swiftly on into panel discussion. Thank you, Tony. Ellen is our superhero. By the way, if you don't know who Ellen is, she is the farm advisor that is going to be working on us with us on farm, developing your plans for landscape recovery. So it's going to be panel discussion time now. If you're burning for a cup of tea because you're freezing, please do, but don't be too long or too noisy, because I think we'll just go straight into it, if that's all right. So John, Ellen, Toby, Neil, where's Tim gone? Remind me, who else? Have a seat if you'd like a seat. Well, no, on the bales. We put them right, so you can be slightly elevated. We'll definitely be bringing people in from the audience to help answer questions. So, Stefan, you haven't got away from it yet. Right, so quick introductions, 2 minutes about what you're doing and how it relates to landscape recovery and the NERF project, if you can.
Hello everyone, so I'm Ellen Fake, for those I haven't met before. So I'm principally from Natural England, work in the Catchment Sensitive Farming Programme, but I'm now on a secondment to the Landscape Recovery Pilot. So I've been working in the Evenload and the Windrush and my other catchments, looking at the same ambitions and priorities that the pilot has. So we're looking at water quality, improving our soil health and husbandry, nature recovery and improving biodiversity. So what I'll be doing going forward is working for all the farmers in the room, producing the land management plans and where we're going to deliver these ambitions for nature and landscape recovery across the catchment.
Toby Kelly, work as a local agronomist across the catchment. Primarily, obviously, agronomy is, you know, looking after crops, so on, but as we are adopting all these new aspects very much, you know, work with a lot of people with regen, working with organic people, livestock, trying to piece it all together. Actually, agronomy now really is a much broader spectrum than it used to be. So I'm trying to integrate these ideas from a farming production side of things, but trying to make sure that we can create that sort of holisticness together. So yeah, that's my role in it all.
So, hi, I'm John Storkey from Rothamsted Research. I'm a colleague of Stefan, who you met earlier, demonstrating the soil sampling. So I'm an agroecologist, which just means that I try and apply ecological principles to agricultural systems to make them more productive and more sustainable. Rothamsted takes a very production-oriented angle, so that's our priority. So when we talk about natural capital at Rothamsted, we're interested in the contribution that natural capital make to the production system. So for example, soil carbon, we're not necessarily interested in soil carbon in itself, but we're interested in the contribution it makes to the functionality of that soil in terms of hydrology and nutrient and supporting crop growth. When we talk about biodiversity, we're interested in functional biodiversity for regulating pests and weeds and pollination. So that's the angle we're coming from. The specific piece of work that Stefan and I have been involved with the cluster was the baselining of soil carbon that was done last March across, I think, 670 or 680 fields, where we sampled at two depths, and we've quantified, importantly, the carbon stocks, because we also measured the bulk density of the soil. So we know the absolute amount of carbon that is in the field, in the landscape. We're using those data in two ways. Firstly, we're using it to refine the baselining protocol, so we can offer you a very cost-efficient way of baselining and measuring your soils. And the second way we're using it is to identify opportunities at the cluster level to capture carbon and potentially access natural capital markets.
Oh dear, I've got to follow that. Okay, Neil Nicholson, two hats on. One is Nicholson's local forestry company, private forestry company. You met Nathan this morning, so we do all the tree planting and hedge planting on this farm, so that's why we're involved. I've also got my other hat on, which is Forest Canopy Foundation, which is a not-for-profit organisation set up about 2 or 3 years ago to get private sector forestry companies to work together to increase the tree planting that we're not doing currently in England. If you think the targets should be about 7,000 hectares a year, last year we achieved about 2,200 in England, so we're well behind the target. Why aren't we achieving that? We're not achieving that because there's not enough money in the kitty to persuade landowners and farmers to plant trees. So we're working quite hard with Forestry Commission and DEFRA to look at ways that we can value the natural capital assets of tree planting and monetize them, which hasn't been done before, in a way that we can then sell the bundled carbon at a higher rate and persuade landowners to go into it. And I'm happy to talk about that later in detail.
Brilliant. Do we have any questions for the esteemed panel at this point? Okay, John, I'm going to pick on you first, because we've had two, three days of really interesting conversations with some of those baseline farms. They've had back, and using those as reference points to interventions on other farms. and this is all part of the NERF project, so that we can bundle that up, call it additionality when we come to go into these various interventions. So landscape recovery is one vehicle, but there's also, if you were to go into a different farming system, such as wild farmed, looking at what the uplift of soil carbon would be and other natural capital. So John, could you just share acronyms. Natural Environment Investment Readiness Fund. So shall I do a 1 minute on that? When we were scratching around for some money for taking our baseline to the next level, so understanding our baseline, what does that mean? What are we going to get if we do this intervention and capture more carbon? I used instead to do that analysis. Meanwhile, you've got Oxbury, who are wanting to support projects that are investing in natural capital and give favourable rates on borrowing for that, in a nutshell. And then a group of farms that are looking at these alternative farm management land use changes. So, for instance, from permanent pasture to a wood, or from arable to permanent pasture, whatever it might be. We've used Rothamsted to unpick what that estimated carbon uplift will be. And then the idea is this is all evidence to then put into our landscape recovery and lever this finance, or support borrowing for better rates, and also refine the Roth-C model, which is the generic model that everyone seems to use against IP rules, I think, that was developed by Rothamsted, but it's the basis of a lot of carbon calculations, but it's quite crude. So it's about how we refine using the data we've got. Anyway, John, any takeaways from the last 2 days?
Yeah, really just to emphasise the value of collaborating at a landscape scale and a cluster scale. So one of the things we can do with the data is, well, what we've been doing, and those of you who've been involved will know this, we've benchmarked the fields. So we know that the amount of carbon in a soil is dependent on the properties of that soil. So if you've got a lot of clay, that protects the carbon, and your potential to keep carbon in the soil is higher. So in order to compare how well you're doing in terms of the carbon in your soil with your peers, you need to compare like with like. You need to look at a similar soil type. So one of the things we've been able to do is, because we've got such good coverage across this landscape, this area, we benchmark fields against similar. So you can under similar soil type and similar context. The other opportunity that that gives us is to look for reference field. A field over here that's under this type of management on this soil type, what would happen if we change that soil? And we can look at the cluster, we can look in the data set for that endpoint, that reference field elsewhere in the cluster, and then that gives you pretty good evidence of saying, well, if you started managing the field that way, whether it be arable reversion or whether it be strip tillage or living mulch or whatever, that gives you an idea where you might go and how long it might take you to get there. So I think that's the real value of working together, that we can, yes, we're combining experience, but we're also combining real physical evidence and data on how the soils in this area behave and how quickly we can improve them through a change in management.
Questions? Brilliant. Thanks, Matt.
Hi, Matt from the local Nature Park. interested in the extent to which you think the evidence is robust enough to leverage private finance.
Okay, so that will bring in lots of issues around precision and uncertainty. So everything we do and everything we will say from Rothamsted will be couched in uncertainty. So we will say, we think this will be the direction of travel in the order of magnitude. So, for example, we would be reasonably confident if we're talking about arable reversion, land use change from an annually cultivated field to a permanent grassland or planting trees. Then you would have a reasonably high certainty that you'll get uplift in carbon, and you would say, well, the order of magnitude would be, you know, 3 or 4% if you did that. Where it becomes much more difficult is when we start talking about these regenerative ag practices, like reduced tillage, living mulches, cover crops, because the impact of those things on soil carbon is much more subtle. And also what we're talking about is not, when you plant trees, it's like putting money in a savings account. You're accumulating carbon over time, and it's just on an upward trajectory. With these regenerative approaches, rotational grass and, you know, annually cultivated systems, it's more like a current account. So the money's turning over, and it's much more challenging to, you know, with certainty say you're going to have 3% more carbon in 10 years, because it's a much more dynamic system. So what we're working on and what we're thinking about is how we can understand the dynamics across the whole farm and make sure that on a farm scale, not a field scale, a farm scale, you're always in net credit. But that's much more challenging, and there's lots of quite difficult science to do before we get there. Arable reversion, land use change, planting trees, fine. You know, we've got reasonable certainty around that. Some of this regen ag, you know, stuff, much more difficult. Would you agree with that, Stefan?
Some more questions?
Rob Stockley, forester with Nicholson's. You were describing a lot of the soil sampling techniques that you were using for assessing the sort of cash balance of a field over time. What progress are you at with using remote sensing to sort of extrapolate that across the landscape scale to reduce the unit area cost per hectare for farmers?
I was looking at Stefan, but he was deliberately not catching my eye. Okay, so Stefan, do you want to take that one? Oh, go on.
We're a team.
I'm not sure. It is a quite difficult question. I mean, using satellites for monitoring carbon will be difficult. I mean, there will be always a level of ground truthing needed to be included. So I don't really believe in you can do it from the satellite alone in my foreseeable future. So I do think there are opportunities. We also have actually a new colleague who is our new carbon specialist, who is then including also more modeling work. And he does have examples where they did this on a smaller scale, county scale or so, where they do have very promising results. But there's a bit of research still involved until we get there, I think. I mean, I think that's the best I can say. Back to John.
He's got his hand in his head, but I really want George to comment on this. Oh, sorry. Do you want to comment on satellite technology for carbon?
Yeah, I'm totally landed next. I was just checking my emails. So I was caught out, wasn't I? George Houston from... Okay, thanks, Tim. George Houston from Downforce Technologies. I think Earth observation and remote sensing has its part to play. There's basically a spectrum of, you can take a physical soil sample in the ground. You've got over here, you've got everything in between, gamma, electromagnetic spectroscopy, etc., all the way through to remote sensing and just using satellites or drones. And at Downforce, a quick plug, we're using everything really. So we're using existing soil samples from existing data sets, so Cranfield, Soil Grids, Lucas, etc. And then we layer that all up with 25 data sets, and then we use remote sensing on top of that. I think the key message is that no one's perfect, no one has the ultimate truth, if you like, in terms of there being a sort of grid north, magnetic north, and a true north. It's the same with soil carbon. I think we'd all agree that nobody's got a monopoly on truth when it comes to carbon, but all of us are trying to get better, to try and reduce that level of uncertainty and try and get to the true story. And the true story is changing all the time, as we know. It's moving, but carbon codes in the UK, my understanding is that we're not there. I think the NERF project last year produced minimum standards for soil carbon codes, but there doesn't seem to be a political appetite for a national UK soil carbon code in the same way as the woodland and peatland codes. It would be very helpful to have that, but
George actually did spend a lot of time building the groundwork, or trying to build the groundwork for a carbon code for soil, and did a great job of pulling together some great academics on it. But unfortunately, it's a tough one to get over the line. I wanted to challenge Tony on it, actually, because he said standards at one point, and I think it would have been quite helpful, given the audience of farms, to have that soil carbon standard.
I was under the understanding that soil carbon code will come, and will come relatively soon. The other interesting thing that is relatively new, and may be out on the press or not, I don't know, is that the various codes will come under British Standards Institute. So DEFRA has just appointed the BSI to do all the standards. So all the codes will become standards, British standards, and that'll happen over the next 3 years. It's a three-year program with BSI coming in. So that's quite new. That's hot off the press, but week old.
That's good intel. Thanks, Neil. And actually, that loops back to the NERF project, where we will be applying the codes that are in existence or being developed by other NERF projects, trying to cross-pollinate across the NERF projects for the hedgerow carbon code, the agroforestry carbon code, and the soil carbon code, minimum standards, whatever it might be. But that's really interesting that BSI are developing it, or rubber stamping it. Any more questions? What's your name? Where'd you come from?
Tim Coates, I'm from here. Actually, my question is for Tobe about integrated livestock management. So I thought we'd take it away from the soil for a bit and talk about that, and in terms of views on how you think it's going here and compared to other parts of the country that you get to see and how other people are getting on.
Obviously limited to what I've seen here, but I do follow Carl quite a lot anyway. I do work with people where we graze really heavily, to the point that we're grazing every single arable crop, but we've got to have a diversity of crops. So barley, rye, cover crops, catch crops, you know, it becomes a really integrated thing. And obviously working with shepherds, it's understanding, you know, I'm not a livestock person, but I have a rough idea about sheep. So it's making the two work together. One thing I think is really important is I think sometimes it seems too transactional. There should be, you know, I've got to pay a rent and so on. Actually, the sheep are fundamental to the soil health, and they're unlocking so much nutrition, which is completely locked up through chemical imbalances, soil health, low biology. And actually, I think the two work great in partnership. I think that you can do a lot more. But I don't, you know, you've got to take these steps. Don't rush into it. But I think you stated earlier, or somebody stated earlier, about the amount of people wanting to start a car. And it's trying to, you know, liaise with them, because what really makes it work. But from the side of things, you know, I can tell you for hours about it's and the science behind it. But yeah, sheep really have transformed a lot of this Cotswold brash. You know, it's yield limiting. We've got to find ways to make more profitability with a reducing input system, and the sheep really help unlock some of that underlying nutrition, which is just completely bound up for high calcium or high alkalinity, low biology, you name it. So yes, I think, you know, what from what I've seen, it's working really well. But I think that you more steps to go. I would just say, working, you know, as you do with Carl, is so fundamental to making sure it works for the sheep side of things as well as the arable. It can't be done in isolation.
I'm going to bring you in, Ellen, if that's okay. BNG, where are we at with it?
That's pretty enough.
So the latest guidance we had on BNG was on the 21st of February, and that was providing guidance for both people who want to provide habitat creation, habitat banks, but also the stakeholders involved in it. So for anyone that isn't sort of aware, as a background, biodiversity net gain was sort of brought in for the Environment Act, and it will become mandatory in November of this year. So essentially, in the area where the cluster sits in Oxfordshire. Some might be aware of the Trust for Oxfordshire Environment. They're working as a facilitator for BNG at the moment. But one of the things that we want to bring in as a cluster is opportunities for biodiversity net gain. So we're still waiting on the announcement of it to become fully mandatory in November. But the important thing to think about that is the fact that it's set at 10%, but there's the ambition to go higher. So every county, it will be dependent on their local authority setting that. And the ambition for Oxfordshire and Gloucestershire might be slightly different, but we really want to tie that element into the landscape recovery pilots as a whole, I suppose, if that's all right.
That's perfect. Neil, Helena, and anyone else that wants to speak from perhaps the beneficiary side of what we're doing with landscape recovery, unless anybody's got any burning questions, I'd quite like to pick on them, if that's okay. Neil, in like 20 seconds, can you summarise our conversation that we had, which I thought with Dave Gasker and Blenheim, and it was brilliant, and it would be good to share that with the group.
Cool, thank you. Neil Strong from NetWRL. An old forester, so I'm sort of fairly comfortable in green, but glad to be here. I cover the whole of the rail network in Britain, looking at biodiversity strategy. Forestry background made me realise that if people take up the UK, the England Woodland Creation Scheme, there'll be trees planted all over Britain, albeit quite slowly, Neil. But they might be planted next to the railway, and what we need to make sure is that when we do actually run trains, don't write that down, please. We need to make sure that they get to where they need to go on time and safely and not be disrupted by trees on the line or leaks on the line or flood or anything like that. So talked with the Forestry Commission about how we can incentivise people to do that. And then with colleagues, conversation with Dave Gasker and colleagues at Atkins and then Tim last week, looking to see how we can pilot that in a particular area where we might get hedges or trees in the ground that might support the work of the catchment, slowing water down, moving the water in the right places. It just helps in general. It helps with our targets of biodiversity net gain across our network by 2035. But if the stuff's on the other side of the fence, it means when the trains on our side can have habitat is lost and doesn't get in the way of trains on our side of the fence. And then we can incentivize people to do the other biodiversity, the other carbon, the other things on the other side of the fence. But it's that landscape scale that fits, and it just works out within the catchment, within the country. Does that help?
You also have biodiversity targets and carbon targets down the line as well, pardon the pun. So you're a potential customer as well as a beneficiary from the work that we're doing. So a customer in terms of buying credits potentially for the steel and the concrete and everything else and the development that you'll have to do, as well as a beneficiary of flood relief and storing water. Any other questions? Well, I mean, that's remarkable. It actually says 2 o'clock on my watch. Whew. Stick around for a cup of tea, a beer, a chat with the panel, chat with guests, and make sure if you're farming in the catchment, you meet Ellen properly. Because you probably already met her, but she will really be helping develop this farmer-led project. So thanks very much. Thanks to the panellists. Thanks, everyone, for sitting, getting colder and colder and colder, and the soup not being quite warm. But that was my bad. Thank you very, very much for coming. Really good crowd, really good day. But ultimately, Tim and the team, who have been absolutely on it today, particularly because he's feeling like death. thank you very much to Dunthrop. Thank you.